I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. If losing weight is one of your New Year's resolutions, you may want to consider moving. According to Reed Ewing, a research professor at the National Center for Smart Growth, where you live may have a lot to do with how much you weigh. We'll find out why today on Smart City. Also with us is Todd Littman, founder and executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute, who challenges all conventional wisdom on how we ought to be getting around our cities. That's today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Reed Ewing is a former legislator and research professor at the National Center for Smart Growth at the University of Maryland. His 2003 study of sprawl and obesity in American adults was the most widely cited academic paper in the social sciences as of late 2005. His follow-up study of sprawl and obesity in American youth appeared in the December 2006 issue of American Journal of Preventive Medicine. You recently published a piece in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine that suggests teenagers living in sprawling suburbs are more than twice as likely to be overweight as teens living in more compact urban areas. Why?
Well, that's the difficult part. We're not sure why there is this association between sprawl and weight. There are some theories, but they haven't really been tested yet. One possibility is just walking in a car-oriented, sprawling environment. You're driving everywhere, and in a compact urban environment, you walk necessarily as part of your daily life. You don't have to really make time for it. It's something you do to get to the store or the transit stop, and so that's one possibility. Second possibility is that kids living in sprawling environments are just spending so much of their time driving from place to place. They don't have as much extra time to be physically active. A third possibility, and this may sound wild, but I think it's a real one, is that eating habits are a little different in a sprawling environment. Probably most important, the car has become a snack shop for kids and adults. I'm sure we all do it. We take something to eat in the car, and so that's less likely to occur on foot. And it's possible that just the fast food environment of commercial strip development is also having an effect. So those are theories. What we know with a degree of certainty right now, based on our original study and this new one and other work that's been done by others, is that there is an association between the two. If you live in a more sprawling environment, if accounting for your age and your race and your education and your household income and all those other variables that would affect one's weight, if you live in a sprawling environment, you're likely to be a little heavier.
When you say a little bit heavier, what does that mean?
Comparing adults in our 2003 study that was the first of its type to make this connection, it looked like it was about 6 pounds difference between living in a place called Geauga County, which was the most sprawling county of the 448 we looked at. It's outside of Cleveland, and it is sprawling. Versus living in Manhattan. So a 6 pound difference, which doesn't sound huge when you think of the variations in weight we all experience from day to day, week to week, season to season. But if you generalize that across an entire population, it actually is a significant difference in weight. So the population effects can be significant, even though the average is 6 pounds. In children, or adolescents, actually, is what we studied, not younger children, one doesn't think in terms of body mass index as you do for an older person, for an adult, because kids obviously are constantly gaining weight and height and so on. But what one measures then is the probability that a kid is overweight or at risk of overweight. And the difference there between, again, between the most sprawling counties like Geauga and the most compact like Manhattan is about 2.4 times more, a greater likelihood of being an overweight kid in the sprawling county versus Manhattan. It's about 6% of the kids, typical kids, male, white, middle-income family, doesn't smoke, and all the other variables one controls for. About 6% of the kids living in Manhattan would be expected to be overweight for that particular cohort, you know, the kid who's middle-income and college-educated parents and so on, versus about 14% in the most sprawling places. So it's a pretty significant difference if you compare the extremes. Now, if you compare one sort of sprawling environment versus another sort of sprawling environment, the difference is going to be much smaller. And, in fact, most of the United States sprawls very badly. If you look at the sprawl index that we created and has now been used by others in a fair amount of research, you've got a few places, a few counties like Cook and Philadelphia County and San Francisco County and the boroughs of New York that are very compact, and then you have a whole lot of suburban counties that sprawl very badly. So it's not a normal distribution, and in fact, it's very much skewed towards sprawl now in the U.S., which is too bad, and for this reason and others.
Well, you raise several interesting questions. Let me pursue them. When you're comparing the most sprawling counties to Manhattan, which I would assume is the most compact, most dense, then you really, as you say, you're working at the extremes. Can you imagine in the U.S. cities moving toward enough density that it would make enough difference in health outcomes to matter?
I can, but land use patterns change slowly over time. We're clearly heading toward a more walkable environment. Not everywhere, but many places in the U.S. And for a host of reasons, the health reason is probably down the list somewhere. The demographic changes are right at the top. Mm-hmm. The aging of the baby boomers and the fact that, you know, they're not going to want to, not going to be able to drive everywhere as they age, and they're not going to want to mow the lawn and so on. They're going to want a place that's more communal. That's probably number one. And then there are a few other reasons, and public health will enter into the picture as well. And I think it will be an increasingly important reason to live in a more walkable environment, a more compact environment. So acknowledging that there are these factors at work, and also that land use patterns change slowly over time, I wouldn't expect huge changes in the next 5 years, but I think if you go out 15, 30, and some long-range planning now is 50 years, I think that we will be living in a denser, more compact, more walkable society. And you can already see examples of it. Cities that were pretty much written off in the 60s and early 70s, 50s, of course, are coming back. There's a lot of infill housing development, a lot of infill commercial. There is a lot of transit-oriented development, even in the suburbs now, and more every year as light rail lines are built and extended, and even some heavy rail. The new urbanism, which I'm sure you've covered in your talk show, even though it's not necessarily tied to transit, these walkable places, sometimes in the suburbs, will increase physical activity. We actually know that. There's some question about how much, and there's some question about whether there's an offset. If you're more active walking to the store, does that mean you're less active walking on the jogging trail? Or less active in the home on your treadmill? Those questions haven't been answered yet, but these walkable new urbanist suburbs, and there are now several hundred of them, typify what I think is going to happen. And we've got lifestyle centers, increasing numbers of those, and so on. So land development patterns are changing. The main organizations for land development in the country, the Urban Land Institute, representing the largest and most successful developers, the American Planning Association, are all solidly behind these notions of compact development and somewhat higher density as long as there's a choice. And one of the reasons they're backing this kind of smart growth is health. And health has kind of come out of nowhere for planners. If you go back 6 or 7 years, it wasn't something we discussed much, and it's now discussed constantly, and there's a lot of research, and we're beginning to do plans for healthy communities.
Let's talk a minute about the impact of obesity on the health of not only teens but adults, and then on health care cost.
Okay. Well, as I'm sure you've heard from other interviews you've done, the estimates of how many Americans die per year as a result of overweight, not a direct result, it's always something else, but you know, the underlying cause being overweight or inactivity is somewhere between 300,000 and maybe 150,000, something in that range. And estimates come out every couple of years that revise our sense of just how dangerous it is to be overweight. But that those numbers are high. In fact, I believe that that obesity and inactivity are the second most important preventable cause of death in the United States after smoking. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the trends, because smoking is going down, rates of smoking are going down and rates of obesity are going up, they're going to cross sometime in the fairly near future. In terms of health care costs, I've seen different estimates. It depends on whether you look only at obesity, healthcare-related problems, or health-related problems tied to obesity or inactivity or both of them together. But we're talking at least $100 billion per year. So it's a large amount. And the reason I focused on children, or we focused, my co-authors and I, in this recent study, is the emphasis and the interest has sort of shifted a bit from adults to children, and the reason being, of course, if you're an obese kid, you're likely to be an obese adult and have health care problems and be running up the health care budget for an entire lifetime. And so about the time we finished our last study, which was 2003, as we were announcing our results, and the next question was, well, how about kids? And that's why we focused on them. And if you look at just the statistics, kids who are overweight, and ordinarily that the term obese is not applied to children for obvious reasons, but you know they suffer from higher rates of hypertension and chronic inflammation, increased blood clotting. They have trouble with sleep. They have trouble with asthma or higher rates of asthma, gallbladder disease, the same sorts of things that you find in American adults that are associated with obesity. And obesity and inactivity are just kind of a double whammy together. Either one is a risk factor, and you put them together, and your health is going to be significantly less good than it would be otherwise. And that's why the emphasis recently in the last few years on health in the context of city design. We believe, most of us, I think, in urban planning, that the way we design communities actually has an effect, can have an effect on levels of activity and through those levels of activity on health. And as health becomes an obesity and inactivity become huge problems for the United States, or huger problems for the United States, those concerns are carrying over to urban planning.
Let's say I'm an urban leader and I have in my portfolio the cost of public health care. Let's say I'm responsible for that. And I come to you and I say, give me the policies, give me the strategies that are going to make a dent in this problem. I want you to help me do it through land use. What would you tell me?
The first thing I'd tell you is don't focus exclusively on land use. Transportation is equally important, but responding to your question about land use, raise densities, and we have the traditional tool of zoning that has that effect. We typically limit densities. We have maximum densities in our zoning ordinances, but increasingly we are relaxing those and allowing for higher densities in certain places. And there's actually, you can find in code now, minimum densities for certain areas that we want to be walkable. And then, so that's number one is density. And number two is probably land use mix, the degree to which homes are close to or mixed with stores and schools and even workplaces. And relax those single-use zoning restrictions, what are sometimes called Euclidean zoning restrictions, and adopt mixed-use zoning by right, mm-hmm. as some places have done. And the third kind of component of sprawl, at least in the way we measure sprawl, is strip development, and discourage that. We'd much rather have development in centers rather than in linear strips. Mm-hmm. With a center, it may be an auto trip that gets you there, but you can walk once you're there. So give through whatever mechanism you want, through your comprehensive plan or your general plan and then ultimately zoning, give priority to these centers of development, the town centers along the light rail line, Hillsboro and Beaverton and so on in Portland as examples. Give priority to those as indicated by kind of the literature on smart growth. The idea is you put money into these places and you allow fairly high densities and mixed uses rather than just having endless commercial strip development. So those would be the top three in the area of land use. In the area of transportation, we were spending virtually nothing as a country on bike and pedestrian facilities relative to roads before the 1991 Act, the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act, ICE-T, which kind of shifted the balance a little bit. But we're still not spending that much. We're spending a lot more on transit, but really not much on bike ped yet. So I would tell the local leader in your capital budget, shift a few of those dollars from roads to other modes. Connectivity, street connectivity, there's sort of at this point a question about how important that is for kids versus adults. It may be kids are actually more active living on a cul-de-sac, but we do know, for adults at least, that an interconnected street network with more direct routing leads to increased rates of walking and bicycling and transit use. So street connectivity, and there are places around the country, quite a few, that have adopted connectivity requirements and block size restrictions. And it kind of goes on from there. We know at this point how to make a walkable place. And we as planners, and even though we may have messed up in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and one area where the research community in planning and urban planning, my field, I think has fallen short is in evaluating tools. So an urban growth boundary, what do we know about urban growth boundaries? What do we know about impact fees and the effect they have on the density of development? What do we know about adequate public facilities requirements and so on? And we haven't done really enough research on the different policy and program tools to say, this is to your mayor, your hypothetical mayor, this is what you should do first, this is what you should do second. But I think we've got a general idea right now, and there are certain things that we want to do for other reasons anyway, like saving farmland. We want to contain sprawl to save farmland and reduce infrastructure costs. And at the same time, we can hope that that will have some effect on rates of obesity and inactivity in the United States.
It seems to me that one of the problems is that many communities try to cherry pick this stuff. It's like, okay, we'll have our one light rail line, but we're not going to do anything about land use, or you know, we'll do something about urban design with building orientation and transparency, but we're not going to allow mixed use. I mean, it seems to me that there still is lacking in far too many communities a sense of how all these pieces and parts fit together.
I would agree, but I think that we're learning and improving, and we understand that they do fit together at this point. I'll cite a place as an example. Orlando, Florida, in the early 90s, through its comprehensive plan, through changes in its zoning ordinance, through investments, and a bunch of other things, the institution of traffic calming, some public-private ventures, began moving toward a comprehensive model, which included all of those things I talked about before. What are sometimes referred to as the 4 Ds or the 5 Ds or the 3 Ds, density and diversity, which means mix, mm-hmm. and design, which is what we were talking about, urban design, and then distance to transit being maybe the fourth, and destination accessibility, simply having a more compact urban form. Orlando did all those things. Charlotte is doing all those things. They have a very, very comprehensive program to make Charlotte a more walkable place. But you're starting with this huge deficit, and Sacramento is doing a good job, but starting with this huge deficit. So it's going back to, I think, your first question or second question. These things aren't going to change overnight. The bad thing about land use as a tool is it changes slowly over time. So it's going to take quite a while to get out of the hole as well. But once we build these walkable places, and I think there's just universal agreement that there's a greater demand than supply for walkable, mixed use, moderately dense, not really dense, but moderately dense places to live. And everyone is going to at least acknowledge the fact we need choices, and we need to meet the demand for walkable places, and we're not doing it very well right now, but we will, I think, do it increasingly as all these factors kind of push us in that direction.
Well, I look forward to seeing future work. Reed, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks for having me on.
Reed Ewing is research professor at the National Center for Smart Growth at the University of Maryland. After a short break, we'll talk with Todd Littman about new ways to get around cities, and we'll talk to Otis White about new parks and green space and their value. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, as you know, CEOs for Cities did a national survey of college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds last year, and one of the things we found was that in the top five attributes young people were seeking in cities, green space was in that top five. You found similar news that cities are responding to parks and green space as not just for kids anymore.
Yeah. This is actually the story of a generational conflict. It's just not the generational conflict you might think it is. This is between people of the age of 24 and 39, that very desirable, out of college, mobile population that you've talked so much about, and their younger siblings, the 4 to 14-year-olds. And here's where it's taking place in one of the Washington suburbs of Fairfax County, and some of the others like Arlington and Alexandria. So you can sort of see it just across the river from Washington. Here's the deal. These are older suburbs. They do have parks and playgrounds. They're designed for younger kids. They're designed for little league teams and little kids soccer. And these 20-ish folks want to do something else there. They want to play ultimate frisbee somewhere, and so they're coming into conflict with the uses of these playgrounds for small kids. And so they're saying, we want something for ourselves. It actually sort of bubbled up when there was an effort in Fairfax County to take away a volleyball court that was used by these young adults and turn it into a playground. And the obvious answer there is, well, we'll just get more green space, more recreational space. And the problem is that as a fully developed, affluent community, that space is very, very expensive. So they're trying to figure out how to resolve this generational conflict between the little kids and the young adults.
I did some interviews recently with postdoc fellows at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, the very famous hospital there that treats cancer patients. And we were talking to them about what it was they liked about the city, what they disliked about the city, how they had made their decision to come to the city. Two of the people we talked to were actually felt so passionately about things they thought were missing that they had actually invested the little bit of free time they have in making those things happen. And the two things were a skate park and connected green space. It is interesting, and it clearly is one of those desirable attributes that is moving way up on the list of young adults. And so cities are going to have to take a whole new demographic into account when they're planning for their parks and recreation.
You bet.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Todd Littman is founder and executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute. He's author of the online TDM Encyclopedia, a comprehensive internet resource for identifying and evaluating mobility management strategies. Todd, citizens in every city in North America are worried about their expanding commute times. We've tried more roads, wider roads, ride sharing, van pooling, but nothing seems to work. Is there an answer?
There are answers, and cities in various parts of the world are successfully solving their traffic congestion problems, but it does require changing the way we approach the problem. So rather than trying to accommodate more car trips, we're actually giving commuters an incentive to use alternative forms of transportation, and so that benefits both the people who shift mode and drive less, and also the people who continue to drive.
What does it really take in terms of an incentive to get people to shift modes?
It takes two things. One is you have to have really good quality travel options. So particularly public transit and van pooling need to be really well organized so that a person who owns a car and can afford to drive would actually choose to leave their car at home and use an alternative form of transportation. In addition, you need a number of support services and incentives so that you're actually rewarding people for using the alternative modes. For example, in many cases, an employee receives a free parking space if they drive. One of the most effective ways to encourage alternative modes of transportation is to allow commuters the choice between that free parking space or its cash equivalent if they use an alternative form of transportation. So a typical commuter would have the choice between either driving and receiving a free parking space or receiving somewhere between $50 and $100 a month in additional benefits if they use an alternative form of transportation. And when we do that, we find that about 20% of the car commutes shift to an alternative form of transportation.
So if I can put $100 in my pocket every month, then that may be enough to shift my mode of transit or transportation.
Right. It doesn't have to change every trip, but it needs to change enough trips that it relieves the pressure on the road system. So that 20% that we get when we offer these benefits, what's called parking cash-out benefits, the 20% makes a huge difference in terms of the level of traffic congestion on the roadway.
Let's go back and talk about quality. What constitutes quality? What are the value attributes that must be present if people are going to judge a public transit system as a good quality alternative?
Well, the transit needs to be fast and convenient and reliable and comfortable and prestigious and affordable. So all of those factors need to be considered when you're evaluating whether your transit system is going to be effective at reducing traffic congestion.
Now, prestigious, that's an interesting value attribute. Tell me what you mean by that. How does a public transit system become prestigious?
Well, you know, you could probably think of it yourself. The automobile manufacturers have become very clever at marketing their products, and transit agencies have to become equally clever at marketing the features of public transit. A lot of people are very happy to use public transit. They would prefer to use public transit part-time, at least, you know, sometimes, if they felt comfortable and proud doing it. And so we need to, partly we need to offer attractive services so the transit system looks nice, it's comfortable and nice, and also we need to educate people about the benefits of transit and highlight the fact that it can be a useful form of transportation for many people and that it really fits into people's lifestyle.
In so many U.S. cities, the transit system today serves a population that has no other options. So transit, by its nature, then is perceived as sort of a last alternative, the choice of poor people, essentially. Now, how do you go from that to a system that is prestigious to it's a prestigious choice?
Well, that's exactly the challenge that we face. And so part of it is improving the service itself. So making it so that, for example, the transit stations are very attractive and that the vehicles themselves are attractive and high quality and not crowded. And then there are a number of marketing techniques that we can use to essentially encourage people to try transit occasionally. For example, some programs they offer commuters a one-month trial, free trial. Somewhere between a quarter and a third of those people will stick with using transit. So part of it is simply getting, you know, once you've got the quality service, so you've got the fast, convenient, comfortable, affordable transit service in your community, then part of the key is to actually get people to try it and try it for a long enough period that they actually see how it can fit into their lifestyle.
Do you find that people are more likely to use transit when they can rely on transit 7 days a week for most all of their needs? I'm thinking, do you find that systems that are complete systems that really can serve an individual 7 days a week and in many parts of their life has a better chance of getting ridership than systems that only provide, say, a commute?
Yes, well, that's another part of the challenge that we face is, as you point out, it's very expensive to own a car, but most of the costs are sunk or are fixed. And so that gives vehicle owners an incentive to drive. They feel like they've got to get their money's worth. So you're right that anything that we can do to reduce per household vehicle ownership, so that, for example, you're helping a household go from 3 cars to 2 cars or 2 cars to 1 car, certainly encourages public transit ridership. And yes, the cities that have well-established rail transit systems, people who live in those cities do tend to own fewer cars, and that's probably part of the reason that you get very high ridership rates, is that you're helping to create a truly multimodal city where people don't feel like everybody has to own a car and have those sunk costs. On the other hand, there are some things that we can do to both help people reduce their car ownership and shift some of those fixed costs into variable costs. One of the projects that I'm working on now, and I think makes an awful lot of sense, is what we call pay-as-you-drive vehicle insurance. And what that means is that insurance companies shift the way they sell insurance so that it's priced by the vehicle mile rather than the vehicle year. So, for example, your broker, instead of quoting you, say, $1,000 a year for this policy, they would quote you, say, 5 cents a mile. And so by doing that, you pay according to how much you drive, and it gives you a new opportunity to save money by reducing your mileage. If we can achieve pay-as-you-drive insurance, it means that a commuter who leaves their car at home and uses public transit on a particular day would save an extra $2 or $3 on a typical vehicle, of course, depending on how far their commute is. But it would give the commuters additional rewards for using those alternative forms of transportation. But that's just part of it. There's a whole range of strategies, what we call transportation demand management strategies, that give people more incentive to use an efficient form of transportation when they can. Another important component of this is what we call location-efficient development. And what that means is that we're encouraging more development around the high-quality transit corridors. And this is particularly important for lower-income people, because there's nothing worse than encouraging low-income people to buy a home way out in an isolated area where they're going to, even though they save some money on their housing costs, they end up spending even more money on their transportation costs. We can do this as public policy, where we make an effort to ensure that there's affordable housing located along the transit lines, and help households reduce their transportation costs. For example, ensuring that there will be car share services in those residential neighborhoods. And that means that there's car rentals services particularly designed to substitute for car ownership.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Todd Littman. He is founder and executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute. Todd, I want to talk to you about a couple of things you've mentioned. The vehicle should not be crowded. Do you think in any way a vehicle being crowded actually communicates prestige?
Let me tell you about some of the research I've done and put this into perspective. Cities all over North America, especially the ones that already have high-quality transit services, are under a lot of pressure to improve the service quality, make them more comfortable. And so the transit agencies know that they need hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in investment, in reinvestment. Now, this isn't anything surprising. Any public facility requires regular reinvestment. And, in fact, the interstate highway system is going to require hundreds of billions of dollars in reinvestment over the next couple decades itself. So it isn't unique to transit services. But when people talk about, you know, this reinvestment, there's often a feeling of that it's unrealistic, that the amount of money that's required to bring our transit systems up to a high quality of service is just too great. And the research I've done shows that the cities with the high quality rail transit systems in North America do require citizens to pay about $100 a year per capita in additional taxes to pay for that quality service. So your public officials would have to come to you and say, okay, we need a tax increase. We need some sort of tax revenue. Now, it doesn't necessarily need to come out of your pocket. It could be coming largely from businesses and other sources. Now, that seems like a huge amount until you look at what the benefits are to the consumer. Residents of those cities with the high-quality rail transit systems are spending, on average, $500 a year less in transportation costs. So even though it costs a lot to provide high-quality transit service, you get a 500% return on investment in terms of your household's financial savings. That's mm-hmm. not taking into account other benefits, such as reduced per capita traffic congestion delays, reduced accidents, energy and pollution emission reductions, all kinds of benefits. But just in terms of financial benefits, you're getting a 500% return on investment.
In that calculation, are you assuming that one still owns a car?
I use standardized national statistics on consumer expenditures produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So you can go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics website and you can download the annual consumer expenditure survey, and it's broken down by cities, and you can see on how an average household in different cities spends their dollars. And one very interesting finding of my research that I don't think has gotten the attention that it deserves is that the households in the cities with high-quality rail transit spend about $500 a year less per capita on transportation than households living in more automobile-dependent cities, despite the fact that the cities with the high-quality rail transit systems have significantly higher average incomes, and so you would expect that that would lead to greater expenditures per capita on transportation rather than less, lower. But this shows, this very clearly indicates the benefits to consumers of having this high-quality transit service available.
Is your analysis available online?
Yes, it is. It's a paper posted on our website. Our website URL is vtpi.org, VictoriaTransportPolicyInstitute.org, and the particular report is called Rail Transit in America: Comprehensive Evaluation of Benefits, and it compares U.S. cities based on the performance of their transportation system, comparing the cities that have high-quality transit systems with those that don't.
You specifically in this case are looking at rail. Why not bus? Is there some fundamental difference from a consumer standpoint of buses and rail?
Well, there do seem to be some differences in terms of consumer attitudes. That is, it does seem like discretionary travelers, that is somebody that owns a car and could drive for a particular trip, is somewhat more likely to use rail than bus. Although there's a lot of debate as to whether we can design bus systems that have that attractiveness and whether the lower capital costs of buses might justify spending more money, investing more of our dollars on improving bus service rather than rail. But to my mind, there's something more critical, even more important, that needs to be considered when comparing bus and rail, and that is that rail transit systems seem to have much greater effect on land use. That is, in a lot of situations, the rail station becomes the center of what we call an urban village.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a neighborhood where not only do people use public transit when they're going on longer distance trips, say commuting, but it also becomes the kind of neighborhood where when it comes time to, say, pick up a carton of milk or rent a DVD or take your children to school, that you're much more likely to walk. In other words, part of the effect is the leverage that rail transit has on neighborhood land use development patterns. And that is a very significant, very important benefit that rail transit can provide. And unfortunately, it often gets overlooked in the discussions. But to the degree that we can use rail transit investments as a way to redevelop smart growth cities, that is, cities where more trips can be made by walking and cycling and public transit, and where households can reduce their car ownership, to the degree that rail can provide that leverage effect, it can provide very, very large benefits. And so I do think that in a lot of situations, rail transit investments are worthwhile for those reasons, but I am not anti-bus. I think that your transit system has to be an integrated network that includes both bus and rail. And also, I think there's a very significant potential for also relying on van pooling. So I'm a great supporter of van pooling in addition to conventional fixed route bus and train.
What's the most exciting thing you're seeing now in bus transit?
Well, there is an awful lot of innovation, and it reflects a lot of these things that we were just talking about, ways to improve service convenience and speed and comfort and prestige. I think it's very important as much as possible to provide bus priority on the road system, so that can mean electronic controls that allow the bus priority going through intersections. It can be bus-only lanes. It can be bus-only lanes at intersections. And there are a number of strategies that we can use. So that's part of it. The highest quality systems are called what is called Bus Rapid Transit, or BRT, and that is a very sensible approach to take, especially in areas where you can't justify a rail transit line, but you want to encourage transit service. And then there's a lot that can be done simply by improving the comfort and convenience to passengers in the buses. Sometimes that means more frequent service so that the buses aren't as crowded. It means having nicer seats. It could mean, especially for the suburb to city commutes, to actually have a special subscription service so that when you get on the bus, your favorite newspaper is sitting there on the seat for you, and you've got a little fold-down table where you can put your notebook computer and get some work done. You would have lighting. You could have an espresso machine on the bus. Public transit agencies could design their services to provide those kind of those premium features that consumers have become to expect from businesses. So we could have all kinds of innovative types of transit service that meet different niche markets.
And point me to a couple of cities that you think are doing the best job in terms of buses.
Eugene, Oregon is just about to start on a bus rapid transit line. Colorado Springs is just established funding for BRT systems. City of San Francisco is establishing a major BRT system that will be open in 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles has tried bus rapid transit, although they didn't include enough, I don't think they did an aggressive enough system, and so it has not proven to be as effective as they had hoped. And I think they need to continue improving it. But it is being developed all over North America and all over the world. In fact, the best systems are in South America and Asia, where a lot of cities have made major commitments to bus rapid transit, and we're seeing great successes there.
Todd, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Todd Littman is founder and executive director of the Victoria Transport Policy Institute. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. From the 15th to 17th centuries, ships navigated the globe in search of trade to support European countries in a time known as the Age of Exploration. City View's commentator Walker Smith examines our shrinking world and considers if there is anything unique left to discover.
Between Google Earth, MapQuest, and Hertz Neverlost, our world is pretty well known and mapped. All the relevant details are captured in these and many other databases. Hundreds of satellites instantaneously put every inch of this geographic information at our fingertips, and all of it comes tagged with everything we could want to know about every place we might want to go. Pick a location, and you can find whatever is connected with it. Nearby restaurants, hotels, stores, or services, pertinent reviews, links to relevant information, or more, even stories and local color. We inhabit a network geography packed with rich information. With every new invention, our world becomes ever more documented and defined. Is there anything more that could possibly be left to discover? Well, as it turns out, lots. Just ask California State Park Ranger Brett Mazur. During his investigation of an attempted carjacking near Castle Crag State Park in Northern California, He was at the home of the victim interviewing him when through the living room window he saw a streak of white on a nearby mountain. He asked if it was snow. No, he was told, it's a waterfall. The man kept a telescope focused on it and offered to let Ranger Mazur have a look. What he saw descending below a 6,000-foot granite formation was a 500-foot waterfall that had no name, is on no map, and to that point was unknown to all but a few locals. And even they couldn't always see it. Bright sunlight and winter snow made it invisible. This waterfall on Root Creek is not the only newly discovered waterfall in that region. For years, Russ Weatherby, a wildlife biologist with nearby Whiskeytown National Recreation Area, had heard rumors of a waterfall on Crystal Creek. He even ran across a topographical map from the 1960s marked with a dot on the creek with the notation waterfall. He searched there but found nothing. Years later, he was studying high-resolution aerial photographs of that area and saw a small dash of silver that corresponded to a steep drop in altitude. Searching that spot, he found the rumored waterfall at last. It, too, was unnamed and unmarked on any map, and had he not been overly meticulous in his scrutiny of those photographs, he says he would certainly have missed it. Both of these discoveries were headline news because it amazes us that in our technologically complex age, nature still holds treasures to surprise us. Yet this will forever be true. We have to remember that technology is nothing but a way to harness and utilize the resources nature has to offer. No matter how sophisticated our technologies become, nature is more fundamental, and thus will always have a little something more for us to discover. Unless, of course, we allow our technologies to overwhelm the balance that nourishes the diversity and vibrancy that makes nature so prolific and so delightful in all that it provides to enrich our lives. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.